Aloha. This is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us on this Aloha Friday, September 13th. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It's Hawaiian History Month, and today we rebroadcast stories about members of the royal family. It was in the month of May that Princess Kaiulani set sail from Hawaii to Europe. We follow her footsteps through Brighton, England, and Paris, France, as we reflect on the ties of the past and present. We'll also spotlight a couple of royal siblings who compose music, which we enjoy today. Plus, we learn why a hotel in San Francisco has included a nod to the Merry Monarch in a new corner museum. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. September marks Hawaiian History Month, and today we're sharing stories we've aired about the ali'i, or our Hawaii royals. We start with Princess Kaiulani, the last heir apparent to the Hawaiian throne. She was the only niece of our last king, Kalakaua, and his sister, our last reigning monarch, Queen Liliuokalani. Kaiulani was sent to boarding school in England following the death of her mother, Princess Miriam Likelike. While in Brighton, the princess spent several years under the watchful eye of governess Phoebe Rook. Jane Caldrey teaches creative media at the college in Brighton and Hove. She used the princess's story to teach her students a bit of the town's connection with the islands and produced a film entitled A Princess in Hove. It's told through the eyes of Rook and is set in the flat where the princess once lived. Take a listen.
Young lady. She was barely 17. A child. Her mother dead. Sent over from Hawaii to learn how to become a lady. A queen. Well, I'd assured Mr. Davis, her guardian, that nothing would be left to chance. My preparation of a future monarch, albeit one from a tiny group of Pacific islands, would be exact in every department. I would at all times, and in every way, remain diligent as to the import of my role. But she was still a child, for all that. I was told later, after everything that happened, of how she had first described me in a letter to her aunt. Mr. Davis has kindly found a lady who will look after
and be a sort of mother to me while I am in Brighton.
Jane Caldrey's film was screened in the summer of 2018 in France as part of the 25th anniversary of Halau Hula o Manoa, a Paris-based halau which traveled to Brighton to teach a hula created in honor of the princess. It screened at a pavilion on the shoreline of the Seine. Director Jane Caldrey recalls the making of the film.
She was so very young when she was here, and it was quite a special time in her life. And, you know, it's just a very long way from home. It must have seemed very strange and very different to her. And I just sort of felt an empathy for her. And I felt that people in Brighton and Hove needed to know about it. And Brighton is a place where it's always attracted interesting people. We have quite a collection of eccentric people who have lived here over the years. And it's part of the story that I felt people needed to know about, really.
And I know when I visited Brighton and went through the pavilion, I can just imagine what it was like for the princess when she lived there for several years.
Yes, it was very different back then, of course. In 1892, it was not really much more than a village at the time. Brighton is made famous by George IV, who came here and made it a resort town. So people used to come here and take the waters and come for the health. And I think it was, you know, a place that she came for her education. And it was before she came out officially. So she was never officially presented to Queen Victoria. So she was sort of slightly under the radar while she was here. She wasn't, you know, in the newspapers as such. It was a time where, you know, it was all about her education. I felt that she formed a very special relationship with Phoebe Rook. And my little film is we were trying to present that, really, because I think for Phoebe Rook, who was all about education, she sort of committed herself to trying to help the princess who was intended to be queen. And I think it was quite a special relationship between the two of them.
And so what was it like filming in the actual unit where she lived?
It was very special. We were in, it was very kind of the people who lived in that house to let us to use their apartment. It was really lovely just being in that part of Brighton and Hove where she would have been, the street she would have used, the church she would have gone to, and the walk down through the gardens to the seafront where you've got the little pavilion, which she would have known, you know, and you can't help but feel a sort of connection to her and the sea looking out. Hawaii must have felt like a very long way away. It felt quite special. And as you know, we did a little performance of the dance in the pavilion on the seafront with some girls from Brighton City College where I teach. And, you know, for them, Hawaii is a long way away. And I think it was very special for them to be involved with the dance and to learn something that was very new and very different. It felt very special for them.
Right, because they were about the same age that the princess was when she lived in Brighton.
That's right, yeah. About the same age as the princess, and you know, their lives are very different. It was nice for them to have this sense of a connection with somebody from a long time ago. To have that connection felt quite special. I teach in a college for students sort of 16 to 19. It was great to get everybody involved. So we had students doing makeup and doing the photography, helping with the dance, helping with the filming and the editing. It was very much a felt like a community project. So they gained quite a lot from doing it.
Did you have a little screening there in Brighton when you finished
the
film?
Yes, we did. Yes, we screened both the films. And we were part of the Brighton Festival in May. That would have been the year before last. Yeah.
Okay, but we have yet to really screen it here, and you have to come.
Well, I'd love to, but it is a long way away. Yes, I'd love to come and screen it in Hawaii. And it'll be interesting to look at other parts of her story, like you mentioned Jersey and the part of the life which was in Paris, which I think was also very important. And, I'd be very interested to see Hawaii, obviously, is a key part of the story. You know, she was a young woman who was very brave, and she had to put her, you know, she was perhaps quite naturally shy and reticent, but had to be very brave and put herself forward to speak up for herself and her country, which I think was an important connection to make with the young people here. It was a very enjoyable and fantastic something to be part of, really.
Right, because you were able to bring that bit of history alive again.
I think so, yeah, yeah.
Tell us what it was like when you were able to actually track down the apartment where she lived.
Well, I just went and knocked on the door and said, hello, do you know that there used to be a Hawaiian princess that lived in your house? Which obviously they didn't, and were quite surprised and delighted. It sounds very exotic and quite different to, you know, it's just not what you expect. And the young couple who lived there were very welcoming and open, and allowed us to come in and film in the apartment and to look around, which was great. And we filmed there. We filmed in the streets locally. And we showed the film and a small exhibition at Hove Museum of the artwork that had been involved in the film. And it meant that local people were able to come and visit and learn a little bit about the princess and her time here, which was very successful.
So it was well received.
Yes, it was. Yes. Yeah. It's had a lot of interest, which has been really good.
Any plans for part two?
Well, I don't know, really. It would be interesting to look at other parts of her life. And, you know, we have a fourth plinth. I don't know whether you know about it. In London, they have temporary exhibitions often in the fourth plinth, which is where the statues in Trafalgar Square. But we have a plinth in Hove. And I was thinking it would be lovely to have the statue of the princess here. So maybe that's a project that I could look at trying to raise interest in that.
That was Jane Caldrey, who produced a film about Princess Kaiulani's time in Brighton, England, told through the eyes of her governess. Here's another clip.
The white jasmine. It was her favorite flower. The princess. The one she loved to paint more than any other, and with such consummate skill. One could almost smell the scent. Pikake, I believe they call it. I wonder now how her life would have been had she been able to follow her artistic path without the trials and tribulations of the Hawaiian throne. But then we would never have met. And her short time with me here in my home in Hove was something of an oasis.
HPR also searched out a Paris address where Princess Kaʻiulani stayed in the 1800s. During some digging at the Hawaii State Archives, we came across letters that she wrote home over time in the City of Lights and in the south of France. All that came together as we began tracing some of her steps in Europe. We found the address of an apartment where the princess lived. 37 Marceau Avenue is not far from the Arc de Triomphe. It's now a 3-star boutique hotel with just 35 rooms. The staff at Hotel Marceau Champs-Élysées was delighted to learn of the Hawaii connection to Hawaii royalty. It was a bit of history that was also a surprise to Maile Kaku. She's a Hawaii transplant who dances with Halau Hula'umanoa, a halau that started in Paris. She's our link to the princess's past in Brighton. She consulted on a film put together by students at the college in Brighton, England, which touched on the princess's time overseas. Here's Maile Kaku.
So we thought we would try and bring the spirit of the princess back to Brighton through a hula. So we set out to find a hula in a way. Also, part of the project was to teach this hula to kids her age who were in a dance program in Brighton. And so it was sort of a long search, and Kilohana Silv, our kumuhula, really became very enthusiastic about it and helped us out and did a lot of research and found that her kumu, Auntie Ellen Castillo, had actually choreographed a dance about Kaʻiulani for Mary Monarch. And then it was another, we tried to find the dance. It was not on internet and it was not on YouTube. And she finally found it in a VHS version in an old box in her attic. And then we had to convert it. And that's how our halau became involved in that. And then we sort of went back and re-choreographed the dance so that the young kids in Brighton could do it. Princess Kaʻiulani had, she lived 9 years, for 9 years of her life here in Europe. And the fact that she lived here in Paris, we don't know very much about what she did here in Paris. And we'd like to find out more in order to honor her presence here in Paris.
Kaku was touched by a letter the princess wrote home of a fatal fire that broke out at a charity Grand Bazaar event she was to attend. A new gown was ready and all laid out. Her father, Archibald Cleghorn, was planning to escort her there, but a migraine headache changed those plans and may have saved her life. Kaku reads an excerpt.
My dear aunt, many thanks for your kind letter. Annie's sudden death has been a very great shock to both of us. I can hardly realize that the dear girl has gone. I am sorry to say I am not feeling at all well. My nerves are all out of order, and I suffer continually from headaches. I dare say you have already heard of the awful catastrophe which took place here at the Bazaar de Charité. I have never heard of anything so fearful in my life. Nearly all of the 117 victims were women, and young ones too. There is a count next door who has lost his two daughters, girls of 18 and 19. What strikes one so is its being in one's own station of life, the smartest society of women of Paris. The death of the Duchess d'Allemont throws the Austrian, Belgian, and Bavarian courts into mourning, not counting the Arlians and the kings of Naples families. Just imagine all those people gone in less than half an hour. And the dreadful agony that they must have suffered. I have never seen any place so overcast as the gay city of Paris. You see, all the people selling were connected with the highest aristocracy of France. I hope that you are keeping well and that you are enjoying yourself in Washington. I am going on the 18th to Ravensdale, Tunbridge Wells, to stay with the Davies. I hope the change will do me some good.
While Princess Kaʻiulani had planned to move to Paris from England following the events, those plans changed, and the chapter of her life in Paris closed. Next up, our Hanaho show featuring stories of Hawaii royals, music of Kaʻiulani's mother, Princess Miriam Like Like. Stay with us. We'll have that story after a short break.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, committed to the people of Hawaii, working to help keep workplaces safe and protect employees' rights. HIOSH.org.
Your $10 a month donation to HPR helps support your favorite programs and the local people who bring them to you. From illuminating and informative programs on HPR 1 to inspiring classical music on HPR 2 and everything in between, your donation supports your favorite programs and your neighbors who make up the HPR team. Donate today at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and take-out daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Welcome back to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. If you're just joining us, we're rebroadcasting stories featuring Hawaii royalty. In 2019, the Mission House Museum hosted a special concert series honoring our departed monarchs. HPR was in the audience when the Mele Music Series kicked off with the work of Princess Miriam Likelike, mother of Princess Kaiulani. Take a listen to this song that she co-wrote with Queen Liliʻuokalani and others.
It was composed around 1868 and most likely was written in Hamohamo, which was the Waikiki home of our Queen Liliʻuokalani. You will hear some of the influences that we have on our Hawaiian music from the outside world. This is a waltz, and it has a Viennese kind of style to it. We're not going to be doing it as a waltz, but that's how it was originally written. But you can hear these influences that the Queen and our Princess had on the music that they were listening to, the music of the time, and the songs that they were writing. Thank you.
Likelike Davis was under the stars and in the audience that night. Her family lineage goes back to Princess Miriam Likelike and Archibald Cleghorn. Davis's great-grandmother was one of Cleghorn's three daughters from a previous relationship, and so they were Princess Kaiulani's half-sisters from the Scottish side. Davis was thrilled to be part of an intimate gathering honoring her namesake.
I found it to be a wonderful tribute to Likelike's music, first of four events for Eilani Eha. My grandmother was Miriam Mabel Kalikaho Robertson Lucas. Her mother was Rose Kaipula Cleghorn, who was one of three of Princess Kaiulani's half-sisters. So they were the daughters of Archibald and were adopted by Princess Likelike before Kaiulani was born. So that's how we fit into the genealogy.
In addition to spotlighting the royal songwriters, the Mission House Museum was also preparing to celebrate the bicentennial of the arrival of the missionaries in the islands. Cultural Programs Coordinator Po'ai Lincoln explains how the music series pays homage to royal siblings and their musical talents.
This particular program is really to focus in and tell the story of the important role of Hawaiian music in our history and how it was influenced by this space and that particular time in the early 1800s, how Hawaiian music evolved. It is one of the few things where there was large outside influence, missionary influence and foreign influence, that the Hawaiian aesthetic really came through. It did not get swallowed. It became this beautiful collection of the two sources.
And it's just remarkable because this evening, you know, you mentioned that these songs are like, you know, 200 years old.
Yeah.
And they're just so
they're
familiar
still,
to everybody.
Yes, and they're still sung, they're still performed, they're still danced to. And especially like tonight with Sanoi, the arrangement of Sanoi, that is Kopono's arrangement, and he makes it sound like a brand new song. And when you look at the lyrics and the stories they were telling, they're the same stories that we still tell now. And our ali'i who wrote these songs, they lived lives just like the rest of us.
You paid homage to Likelike, and I have to admit, she was one that I did not know a lot about.
There really isn't much to be known. There isn't much about her. And one of seven, and the four that we talk about, Likelike is the least spoken of. And so there are others, three other that had shorter lives who did not live very long. One of their siblings was only 3 years old when she passed. But Likelike really, she kind of kept to her own. She was very much, she was a sovereign woman in a way. She very much had her own life. Her daughter, Kaiulani, is kind of how we know her the most as. And she wasn't really here on Oahu often. She would kind of go away to Hawaii Islands. But the music that she does have, the few songs that were written by her that are still in existence to this day, are stunning. They're just beautiful pieces.
And it was really nice to have one of the descendants here tonight.
Yes, yeah. Auntie Likelike Davis was here. That was really, really wonderful. That was really cool.
That was Mission House's Museum's Po'ai Lincoln. We should note that while other monarchs across the globe were hiring songwriters, Hawaii's royals themselves wrote poetry and songs that we still hear today. Here's Melvin Leeds singing Mai Ka'i Waipio, which translates to Beautiful Waipio, said to be written by Princess Likelike for Queen Emma, whose beauty reminded her of the Hawaii Island Valley.
Mai Ka'i Waipio, Aloha Inapali, Epo'ai Apumi Ana, Ahapa Makai, Mae Mae Kapua, Ika Honu Ae Akawai, Ua Ena Ena Ika. Thank you.
September also marks Queen Liliuokalani's birthday, and so it's fitting we spotlight her music. Back in 2020, we aired a story about four symphony musicians who were so moved by the songs of the Queen that they compiled an album honoring her legacy. Take a listen. The four musicians playing on the album are internationally renowned violinist Eric Silberger and Manwin Lo, as well as local musicians Josh Nakazawa and Dwayne Padilla. Nakazawa starts us off.
We were all playing together before the very first lockdown, and I had invited Eric and Manwin to stay here instead of traveling back to New York and LA to wait it out until it was safe to travel again, and all of our work was disappearing anyway. So during that very last night of our last gig, Dwayne was playing on it as well. We ran through Dwayne's arrangement of a song written by Queen Liliuokalani, one that she wrote while she was in confinement at a palace. And when we ran through it, the feeling was, it was electric. The parallel of feeling confined in a lockdown in Hawaii and the feeling that the Queen might have felt her confinement made us play as though we were really trying to connect with her, with what she wrote. Once we did that, we really wanted to share it, and so we thought that since we had nothing else going on, that we would make some lemonade out of the lemons that we had, and we decided to cut this album, and Dwayne wrote all of the arrangements of all the 15 tracks that are on the album.
To me, it just seems so eerie, you know, thinking about, you know, her state of mind and when she was writing the music and then you folks performing this.
Her music really speaks to a lot of things that are going on. So this feeling of just being isolated because she was incarcerated because of the overthrow. She wrote these songs to capture that sadness. But then, you know, also she turned around and wrote some songs like asking for forgiveness of those who overthrew her. You know, and these times that are so politically charged, that really spoke to us, that kind of thing, too. The thing that impressed us most about it is because we're all classically trained musicians who are just sort of discovering her music for the first time. And she really has the gift of melody in the same way that Schubert wrote a lot of art songs. Queen Liliuokalani is a wise answer to Franz Schubert in the way that she was able to construct these beautiful melodies. Because she had a lot of Western training because her and her brother and sister got a lot of Western training from bandmaster Miss Berger. But also she was able to write melodies that sounded to Westerners beautiful, but also were able to tie into the way people sang from the indigenous Hawaiian music. Like she would tap into using intervals that people use when they sing the Hawaiian falsetto and stuff like that. So she's been able to be a bridge between two worlds, the Western world and the musical world of Hawaii before the first contact.
And so of the songs then that are on this album, do you have a particular favorite?
My favorite is Ka'ipo Nohea. It's actually a lullaby that she wrote for one of her Hanai siblings. That's my favorite one because it's just a tender lullaby. On the album, there's quite a few powerful ones. The one that she wrote, what was originally Hawaii's first national anthem, because I guess when she was still a princess, at official functions, they would play a God Save the Queen, the British national anthem, at all these functions. And then King Kamehameha was like, hey, we should have our own national anthem. So he told Queen Liliuokalani to write one. And in a week, she was able to write He Mele Lahui Hawaii. And she was able to premiere it with at that time, she had just been named choir master of the Kalahau Church, the one on King Street, and she premiered that song there in 1866. That one's particularly powerful.
We're really fortunate to have some really special guest artists that joined us for some of these songs, and Jake Shimabukuro has joined us for Ahe Lamakani, and we also have Benny Rietveld, who's the bass player and music director of the band Santana, who grew up here, and he's playing on that track as well. And he also played on Aloha Oe. He added a really beautiful just magic to that track. And then we also have Greg Sardina, who joined on yet another one. And so it's really been a really beautiful time connecting with so many other great artists to collaborate with.
Well, do you have a favorite?
I would say right now, it changes a lot, but right now, I would say Aloha Oi is just a really, really nice one, or Ahe La Makani.
Yeah, our version of Aloha Oi, it's pretty interesting because the string parts sort of rock a little bit the way slacky guitar does, but then the voicing is also with four-part harmonies like choir. But then Benny Ritfeld, he adds this electric guitar thing to it that totally takes it into the present, but in a very tasteful, beautiful way. It's pretty magical, the Aloha Oi, our version of it.
Well, you know, I have been learning a bunch about our very talented monarchy and was fortunate enough to attend some concerts over at Kauai Hau Church where they featured the music of Hawaii's Ali'i. And it's just fascinating that, you know, they're so talented and the music is just, it's precious to have that.
You know, I was talking to my friend Kylan Reese, who is a musical historian and luthier in town. You know, people have this impression that maybe Hawaii was not that sophisticated, but at that time period, Hawaii's musical scene was very cosmopolitan. He was saying that, you know, before they would run the big operas in New York and L.A., they would do a dry run of the operas here in Honolulu just to test things out. So the musical environment of that time was very cosmopolitan. And so people like Queen Lilikani grew up hearing, you know, symphonic music and jazz music, as well as the local music, as well as hula. So they had a really rich musical environment to draw upon. And we see that in the beautiful music that she writes, that she and her three siblings wrote. You can tell that they were part of a rich environment of music.
I guess historically, most people, most royalty have their in-house composers write music for them. It's really a rare thing and a beautiful thing that she was so prolific as a composer herself.
Yeah, she wrote over 150 songs. And you know, the interesting thing about our album, I was talking with Kylan over coffee once, and he was saying that, you know, before the lap steel guitar, violin was the lead instrument in a lot of Hawaiian string bands at the turn of the century. And people don't really remember the violin as part of Hawaiian music. And so part of this project was just to reimagine what that sound might have been like, you know? Yeah, the sound of violin and Hawaiian music. And I think it sounds good. There are some people that still people remember. Sam Lea is a very famous Hawaiian fiddler that people still remember. But there were other guys too. And, you know, we're trying to rediscover the sound of what bowed strings might have been in Hawaiian music at that time.
Anything else that you want to share with our listeners just about what the experience has been for you?
Part of our process of how we recorded everything was that we had the Queen Liliʻikalani songbook. And in that songbook, it has all of her songs and the translations, as well as a historical background a little bit into the songs. And so what we would do is we would read the historical background out loud with the group, and then we would read the poetry or the song, the lyrics of the song. And we would then have an idea of what we would, how we play it, and then we would record it. And we did that for every single song. And we really hope that that every track is imbued with this process, and that we hope people can enjoy knowing that was our process when we recorded it.
And a tribute to our queen too is that she wrote all the words, or the majority of the words are in Hawaiian, but she did write her own English translation for many of them. So she was also a multilingual musical artist too, which is that made the job easier for us, and it's also a sign of how impressive a musician she actually was, that she could write her songs in Hawaiian and then translate the lyrics into English herself. Pretty impressive, especially for somebody at the turn of the century at that time period. And then also on the album, we had the illustrious Aaron Mahi wrote a beautiful preface about the history of Hawaiian music involving Queen Liliʻikalani and the songs we wrote. So Aaron Mahi blessed us with a beautiful preface to the album too, which is really, it's an exercise in Hawaiian history. It's a real education, just the beautiful preface that he wrote.
Well, I think the approach that you folks have taken to really kind of feel what she was writing and play what she composed, I've no doubt that it's going to be an awesome album.
I wanted to mention one more thing about the album that I thought was really important. We got this really incredible artist to do the album cover work. His name is Solomon Enos, and he's done a lot of really incredible works. And when he made the album cover for us, we had given him our story about how we had formed as a group and what we were intending to do with the album. And he created this image, and which is now our album cover.
That was cellist Josh Nakazawa and violist Wayne Padilla of Mana Music Quartet. The story originally aired September 28th, 2020.
Ai eleli ue nohonani mai. Lili ue nohonani mai. Kokino e ki imili mili.
Komaka.
Komaka e no veo vare. Ko papalina e kukuana. Kopo ohivi ani pe ahi, kopo lie nahe nahe vale. Kopo ohivi ani pe ahi, kopo lie nahe nahe vale.
Kokuli,
kokuli e nuku moi oe, ko vavai kau mai ilu. Kokuli e nuku moi oe, ko vavai kau mai luna.
Last year, several events were held in commemoration of Queen Liliuokalani's 185th birthday. HPR was on hand at one of them that took place at Schofield Barracks Army Base. We were there to remember the Queen's connection to what's known as the Soldiers' Chapel. Members of Hawaiian Royal Societies took part in a gathering to recall how in 1913 the Queen traveled across the island to donate a pair of bronze vases when it was first dedicated. The chapel was used by 13,000 soldiers from the newly established Schofield Barracks.
Pamana kalame ka uanoe, uana ka olioli oia.
Army historian David Crowley, who's with the Army's Cultural Resources Program, says with the passage of time, the chapel was rebuilt. It's unclear what happened to the vases, but a plaque and the Queen's picture hangs in the chapel entrance. Thanks to the efforts of Kahukaleo Patterson, St. Stephen's Church, the Pacific Justice and Reconciliation Center, and the U.S. Army, this annual event recalls that time in history. Here's Kahu Patterson.
It started with an interest in just learning about the history and developing a relationship with the Army and trying to bring the community and the Army together around Queen Liliuokalani and her birthday. And so we've just kind of been working it, yeah, working it and learning from each other. And the Hawaiian societies have started to come in. And, you know, we're hoping it's going to be a development that enhances our community understanding of the Army, and that we're working together to build a, you know, a better place that Liliuokalani envisioned in her own life. It's interesting that in 1913, when the chapel was dedicated by the bishop and a minister from Central Union Church, that in itself was a symbol of reconciliation, I think. And after the chapel was built for the 13,000 soldiers that were here, we have the war starting up, World War II, and then the Queen died in 1917. A year later, the war ended, I think, and so that date. But that date has become a date now. The Episcopal Church commemorates the Queen as a saint on November. Yeah, that history is really significant because, you know, the Queen has the chapel and then she's at the end of the war, right. November 17th, yes. Yeah, so.
And then can you explain, if you can explain the significance, you know, when you think of the Queen coming up here, why would she do this? Why is this symbolic, this church?
Yeah, I think the church, it helps us to understand more deeply her faith. You know, she was a Christian. She had problems with the missionary church. She left Kauai Ha'o Church after she was imprisoned. She was ministered to by the Episcopal Church, which was founded by Kamehameha IV. That history is really interesting to look at, how the role of the churches in developing in Hawaii was part of the history and the politics of of the day. And so if we follow how the movements of the Queen and in her journey of faith, it's really interesting what she did after, you know, the release from prison, going into the Episcopal Church, and then just participating with the army and engaging with the army. And this place, you know, the royal lands, you know, is significant. And she probably felt it was very important that there was some activity on behalf of the Hawaiians in this sacred lands, Vahipana, Lelehua, yeah, Kukani Loko, you know, all of that. And so she wanted to leave something behind that would always cause us to remember the history of these lands and not just give it over to the United States Army.
And then the Army's historian here talked about the link to the land, because this was a part of Kalakaua's ranch.
Yes, yes. Yeah, so there was the Kalakaua had his ranch here, his retreat home, and so the chapel was built across the street from his lands that had a house and you know, other things. So that kind of tells some of us that, you know, she really had a special feeling for this place, and to be asked to do something on this land was an opportunity for her to reconnect the land and to, you know, remind us about the history of this place. Yeah, so we appreciate that we're learning more about that, and that the Army is opening up about that history. We've had little history in the community about the Queen's role and the role of Kalakaua on these Army lands. And more so, these are Army lands, not the lands of Kalakaua or the Queen. But now we're hoping that history can become more balanced and more prominent in the community and what's being taught in our schools. And this is a, you know, excellent history that should be in the community, should be told and taught to all the soldiers that come to Schofield. Yeah.
And you're about reconciliation and the fact that we have so many members of the Royal Societies here who maybe had not been here before.
Yeah. Yes. So bringing the Hawaiians to Schofield, a land that was territorialized, you know, we lose the history if we don't use the land, if we're not on the land. We lose our connection, we lose our history. So this chapel ceremony every year on the Queen's birthday, you know, it's a very important event to keep everybody connected and to somehow develop a relationship with the Army that's different than what we've had in the past. Yeah, hopefully we can learn together about this land and be
good, gracious,
yeah,
about the history.
Be gracious and be good community partners. Yeah.
And that was Kahu Kaleo Patterson of St. Stephen's and the Pacific Justice and Reconciliation Center. The service at the Soldiers' Chapel featured special music performed by musician and University of Hawaii Professor John Osorio. It included a rendition of He Mele Lahui Hawaii, the anthem that the Queen originally composed for the kingdom that was eventually changed to Hawaii Ponui by King Kalakaua.
Kamakua
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Occupational Safety and Health, also known as HIOSH, recognizing September as Suicide Prevention Month. Learn more about risk factors, warning signs, and how to help at afsp.org.
This Sunday on The Real Deal, it's the soulful sound of Cannonball Adderley, one of the most popular jazz musicians of the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. Join me, Seth Marco, this Sunday, 8 to 10 on HPR 1, Cannonball Adderley.
David Kalakaua, known as the Merry Monarch, reigned from 1874 until his death in 1891. He died while traveling in San Francisco, when in the city by the bay he had often called the historic palace home. Sadly, during his last visit, he suffered a stroke and died. Today, visitors may be surprised to see a pair of throne chairs with a plaque noting that they had been donated to the hotel as a gesture from someone in his family. The Victorian-era chairs are a nod to just a few of the hotel's connections to Hawaii. We talked to General Manager Angie Clifton about the chairs and Landmark 18, a new museum corner carved out in the hotel that includes a mention of the ties to the islands.
He was attending a number of social events in the city and negotiating with John D. Spreckles, who was interested in growing sugarcane in Hawaii. So shortly after the king arrived in the city on January 20th of 1891, and at the time he was the last reigning king of Hawaii, sadly he passed away at the hotel. So to pay tribute to the king, the palace flew the Hawaiian flag, lowered it to half mast, had it prominently displayed outside the palace, and it said that the king's ohana gifted those beautiful throne chairs to the palace in appreciation for our years of sharing true aloha spirit with King Kalakaua and his staff. So they were a generous gift to the palace from the king's ohana. And as you mentioned, these magnificent throne chairs still sit prominently in our palace lobby today.
Yes, I mean, they're beautiful chairs, and you know, I understand that there are pictures of it when the current Palace Hotel was reopened, because the original one burned after the big earthquake
right.
over there.
Yeah, so the Palace Hotel actually survived the 1906 earthquake. The structure survived, but it succumbed to the fires. And the story back from then was that the water that could have been used to put up the fires here was used to put up the fires at the Mint, which was across the street from the hotel at the time. So unfortunately, it did meet its demise, but was beautifully rebuilt in 1909 and reopened at that time.
I understand, walking through your hallway last year, that you folks have created a little museum space where you mentioned the king's stay there and the history and the ties to the hotel.
So the name of the history museum is Landmark 18, and Landmark 18 is an ode to our garden court structure. Our garden court restaurant and area is actually a designated indoor landmark for the city of San Francisco and the only indoor designated landmark for the city, and on the registrar is noted as Landmark 18. So the name of the history museum is an ode to that designation, and it was unveiled in May of 2020. It took over a year to curate from our archives, and definitely a collaborative effort between our area general manager, Clifton Clark, and two people who had worked at the Palace Hotel for more than 20 years. So definitely a collaborative effort and a true labor of love. So a labor of love. It was created for our guests to enjoy and immerse themselves in the history of the palace, but also created with our employees in mind. The museum is another experience for them to share with our guests and something for them to truly be proud of. And our associates, our employees here, have a lot of pride in the palace and the service we provide and in its history. So they love to be able to point out the museum, take the guests to the museum, and help them share in our history. So it's definitely a win with our employees as well. And the museum features a wide array of historic palace photographs, stories, rare memorabilia, photos, postcards. It's really something to be seen in person.
There is a framed picture of King Kalakaua and a calabash and a little write-up of his stay there. And so, gosh, you know, I understand that this was the creation of this little museum space in the corner there was really a way to welcome people back, you know, after the pandemic shutdown, you know, because there's so many places were basically closed off. I mean, it was hard, I'm sure, right, for the employees, for the guests who, you know, maybe had been booked there.
Yes, it was a wonderful way to take advantage of, sadly, some downtime, but a wonderful way to welcome both guests and employees back into the building with something positive and something that they could celebrate after such a hard time of the hospitality industry in San Francisco and the world going through such a traumatic event. So it was nice to have what I call a silver lining part of that period.
And as I walked through there, you know, like I said, I didn't realize that Kyoya was also another connection to Hawaii.
Yes, it's wonderful to have those ties and to have such a connection and that Ohana spirit with our sister properties over in Oahu and on Maui and have that partnership with Kyoya as far as running the hotel.
Well, I just think, yes, that's the, you know, the sensitivity and the acknowledgement, right? I mean, here on Oahu with the Royal Hawaiian Hotel and the Moana, two of the most respected and historic properties. And to have that tie, I think, is just, it's something special.
It's very special. Even our hotel cafeteria is called Ohana, and we truly do participate in that family Hawaiian Ohana spirit with our sister properties over in Hawaii.
That was Angie Clifton, general manager of the Palace Hotel in San Francisco, talking about the ties between the historic property and Hawaii's monarchy. King Kalakaua died at the hotel 133 years ago. That is it for this Aloha Friday Hanaho show featuring stories about Hawaii's royals. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pote and Tori DeJournay. Our backyard quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up the conversation.